Earth Podcast with your host, Jake Weaver. Engineered by Cedric Swan.
Hey, everybody. We are back with another episode of Midnight on Earth. I'm your host, Jake Weaver, and we are here to bring you more knowledge, more light, and more love. This week, we're bringing you the light of Egypt with Jose Barrera. He's going to tell us about his amazing book. It's a work of art, people. It's beautiful beyond description. It's called Dendera, Temple of Time, The Celestial Wisdom of Ancient Egypt. Oh my God, people, look, you know how much I love the mysteries of Egypt. Egyptian culture. I feel like I'm a reincarnated Egyptian. I just feel this attachment to it. I'm sure Jose feels the same way, perhaps or not. We will learn that when we talk to him. But first, I need you to do something for me. Follow me on Instagram at @midnight_on_earth. That is the address. You can follow me there. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you go to get your podcasts. Click that button that connects us so you know when people come on and they have this unbelievable information, this absolutely incredible contribution to the human experience. You get that notification instantly to your device. And also, lastly, tell a friend. Tell someone that you know that loves these type of podcasts. You know what we're doing here. You know the level of guests that we have and just the positive information we're putting out. You know the people that need that information. We all need it, but some need it even more. Bring them here, midnightonearth.com. Okay, so we're going to talk to Jose in just a second, but of course, first, I have to read his bio. So here we go. Jose Maria Barrera is a software engineer and application architect specializing in data representation and languages, who has been fascinated by alchemy and Egyptian culture for more than 20 years. An avid photographer, his work has been exhibited in galleries in Chicago and New York City and sold at Sotheby's auction. Born in Colombia, he holds a master's degree in computer science. He currently lives in New York City, and he is here with us today. Hello, Jose. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jake, thank you so much for having me.
Well, your book is amazing, man. Look, I love ancient Egyptian culture. I think most people that are fascinated by things, like you said, like alchemy and mystery school information and just deep spirituality, they feel a connection to ancient Egypt. They feel a connection to that culture. It's incredible what you've done here.
Well, thank you so much. I totally agree with you about that connection. And I think a big part of it is the mystery. When you look at this culture and you look at these mysterious figures that they have, their gods, and this language that you cannot read on the walls of all these ancient temples, it sparks your imagination. And I think that that sense of wonder and mystery and what is unknown sparks up a lot of interest on people. And I think that's one of the big things of Egypt, is that sense of mystery and lost knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. You see the pyramids, you see this architecture that cannot be replicated by modern means, and you know even intuitively that they were tapped into some form of information that we do not have today. And that includes physical technology and spiritual technology like magic. I think Egyptian culture, they used magic every single day. What we consider magic, it was like daily life for them. And they used magic to manifest things in addition to doing physical labor and other things to survive. They also had that as a tool in their toolbox, magic.
Right. But you know what, Jake? I don't think that has changed much. I think Magic is in our everyday lives every day here in this society. Even though we think we're rational beings and we are like creatures from the Enlightenment and so on, the day-to-day and our state and everything, our lives are regimented by magical rituals and magical ideas. So I don't think we are too far away from where these people were. We're on the Nile, though. Oh, they were on the
Absolutely.
Nile as well, but a different Nile.
Not the Nile, D Nile. Exactly. That's the thing. We use our mental power, our faculties, our willpower to create things, but we don't understand the mechanics behind it. We just do it. But the Egyptian culture, not only did they understand the mechanics behind it, they went even deeper and deeper into that thinking.
Yeah, it was explicit in their society, I think. So that magical thinking, that magical way of looking at the world and acting and manifesting things out of nothing, which is what creativity at the end is, and this understanding of the supernatural in a good way to understand what supernatural means, I think it was part of their culture. Yeah, absolutely.
It's really interesting that that magical perspective has shifted over centuries and cultures, but it was so prevalent to Egypt. I find that so fascinating. And all the spiritual people that are out there today, it seems like they're communicating the things that were foundational to Egyptian culture, like these deep spiritual understandings that seem to be happening in humanity right now. A lot of people are having these awakening experiences. This was part of daily life in Egypt. Like all of this mystery school knowledge and this information, this alchemical information, this was an integrated a part of Egyptian culture and society. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have is that we live in a system that is fractured in the sense that we have become hyper-rational and we have segmented our field of knowledge in different specialties and people are hyper-specialized. And people in one corner of knowledge forget and have no idea what other corners of knowledge are doing. And more than just knowledge is the types of ways that we have to learn and to know. I think some of them are neglected today because reason took over. And if you cannot quantify something today, then it's not part of the scientific method, which is the only method we have today officially to know, right? And what establishment wants to say is anything that is sanctioned by government or by authority or by, yeah, but the knowledge consensus is has to be rational. And today, right, like what people say is, oh, it's scientific, and everyone pretends to be scientific and tries to bring scientific arguments to explain things. So if something is not encompassed by science, and namely, it cannot be measured, then or is subjective, then what the approach that we have taken is to deny it and say it doesn't exist. So it comes to a point of ridiculousness in my appreciation. That is the extreme of this is to come and say and deny consciousness. So in today's world, there are people who claim materialist reductionists who claim that consciousness is an illusion. And to me, that's patently absurd because it's the only thing we know with certainty.
Right.
Because everything else is a hypothesis and a theory of are we a brain in a bath or are we in a matrix and a simulation? Whatever is that? Or is this real made out of atoms and energy and all this? All those things are hypotheses. But the only thing we know with certainty, absolute certainty, is that we exist and we're aware of our own existence. And that cannot be denied because any theory of what the world is, any story that we tell ourselves of what the world is, has to encompass for that. If that's not part of the story, there is something deeply flawed in the story we're telling because the only thing we know with certainty is not captured by the tale we tell ourselves to explain the universe. So I think that's a deep fracture that we have in our lives. And don't take me wrong, I think Reason is an incredibly powerful tool, but it's not the only tool. And the problem we have done is that now everything looks like a nail to a hammer, and we decided that there is only one hammer, that is reason.
But is quantum physics, though, opening that realm up? It's bridging the gap, it seems, for spiritual knowledge to be processed in a scientific way.
Up to a certain point, I would say yes, but I think there are things that are orthogonal to what you can explain with reason.
Exactly.
So
Yes.
experience itself, like one thing, I can write 1,000 books about the taste of chocolate, and I can make poems about the taste of chocolate, and I can make movies about it, and I can give like the decomposing its chemical parts, what chocolate is, and the color, and the wavelength of the color of chocolate. And I can do all these things about chocolate. But until the day that you have in your mouth a piece of chocolate, and that thing explodes in your mouth, and basically you are in communion with the chocolate, and you become one with chocolate. That's the real knowledge of what chocolate is. As in, it is an experience that you are becoming chocolate, and chocolate is becoming you, right? You are in intercourse with the chocolate. And until that happens, you really don't know what chocolate is. You just have stories about it, but you don't know what it really is. It's just a description of what it would be to feel what not what what chocolate is. But that part, you cannot take that with like that with science. You cannot accomplish it. All you can do with science is give recipes on how to experience chocolate. But
Yes.
experience itself is something that you have to put there. It's a dance between you and the chocolate.
And there's no way to encapsulate that in a way, like you said, you can only go so far with the description until the experience happens. The experience is outside of the third dimension, and it has its own set of information. Like you're saying, you're becoming one with the chocolate. It's like a spiritual experience with the plant spirit of the cacao. That's a whole other conversation. But if we're even scaling that up and talking about the divine experience, when you have direct experience with the divine, you can read any spiritual book and every spiritual book in the world. But if you don't have that direct experience, then it's not going to take you to that next level to get that next set of information. You're always going to be in this lower bandwidth until the experience happens. And there's
All
no
right.
way to communicate personal, direct experience. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely correct.
Isn't that
That you
amazing?
got it. And the funny thing is, once you have the experience, then you can experience the divine in any flower, in any object, in anything, because everything is permeated by that. That is your own awareness of the other, of it. And that's what I think we call God, is exactly that. It's that experience of the other, right?
Oh,
That something that is
absolutely.
not us and is there, but you can experience it.
And you talk about in your book how that is how Egyptian culture processed reality. They saw the divine in everything. You were saying that they were able to like almost reverse how we experience the divine in Western culture.
Correct. I think so. So I think the biggest disfavor that we have done with technology, and again, I want to reiterate, I'm not against technology or
No.
reason. They're a great tool, but the problem, it has drawbacks when you take it absolutely and uniquely, and is you sever your experience from the world, where the world is this meaningless place made out of random collisions of particles and is senseless. And then all you have in this world today to look forward to is to have a nice job and a pension and go to a mall on weekends and consume crap. So that has our lives have been reduced of that, because the sense of the divine and the sense of that we are important in the world, we're not just an accident, is lost. And if you when you think about this and you realize that that happens, is an ideological idea, the idea that we're not the center of the universe, but we're lost in a branch of a meaningless galaxy in the middle of trillions of galaxies, and we are a random accident that came out of evolution and all this. I'm not questioning that, but that's just a perspective. But move the world around and see experientially what is happening. And is from the point of view of an experience, which, by the way, is the only thing we know and we have.
Right.
From the point of view of experience, you, Jake, and I, and anyone for that matter, you are the center of the universe from the point of view of your own experience. And you can travel the world, but what you're going to see is that you're always at the center. Your locus of consciousness, your awareness, is always at the center of the universe. And if you take a walk, the way you perceive that is that the world is moving around you. It's not that you're moving around the world. You're always, your locus of consciousness, your center of awareness, is always at the precise center of the universe. It's always the case, because you cannot experience the world otherwise. You always experience the world from the center of the universe, who is you. So experientially, we live in a geocentric world where we are at the center of the universe and the whole universe revolves around us. And that's just a frame of reference. Now, when you change that, because mathematically it makes more sense to say, oh, the sun is at the center of the universe, because now I can have easier equations to describe the movement of the planets around the sun and the stars. Yeah, that comes at a price. And the price is that now we're not the main characters of the story, but we're just a chance in the universe. And basically that kills the soul and the spirit. And the reason for that is that reason cannot account for the miracle of existence, because you cannot measure that. So at that point, it becomes ideological. So measurement of things is an ideological act, is political. And because that determines the substrata of what the world is and what we understand that the world is. So one of the things that I have, and it's been my personal journey, is that, so I grew up in Colombia. And I was a devout Catholic until I was like probably 12 or 13.
Okay.
And then ever since, like from that day on, what happened is that I became an atheist. And I was an atheist until I was like a real like a militant atheist until I was like 32 or 33.
Like you're and, just worm food. Like you're like as far as there's nothing. It's literally just science and biology.
Everything is biology. And then, but to me, the big question was always, what is consciousness?
Right.
To me, that's the big question. So as an atheist, as a rationalist, and the reason why I ended up here in the States is because I came here to work at the Department of Neuroscience at the NYU Medical Center. Because if you're an atheist, the natural place to look for consciousness is you want to study neuroscience because you want to dissect brains and look for consciousness inside the brain. So, but guess what happens when you take a brain and you start to slice it and take parts out looking for consciousness? At the end, you end up with a pound of meat and no consciousness. It goes away. So reductionism, you cannot reduce consciousness. And that's what happened to me. So I got disenchanted with this rational approach because it doesn't have answers for all the questions, especially for the most important questions that are beyond the domain of science, basically, and reason.
Right. And science, it seems, doesn't even really want to look in that direction. They'll always try to reduce, like you said, consciousness to a physical, biological experience, a phenomenon. It's because a phenomenon, is what they'll say.
It can't do anything else. It can't do anything else.
Right.
Because the methodology of reductionism, right, cannot do anything else. When the only tool that you have in the world is measurement, then things that cannot be measured by definition cannot be part of that theory. But what is funny is that you can still use the scientific method, right? Because at the end, the scientific method, what you're doing with it is you're creating stories that try to describe our human experience. That's all we're doing with science, right? And what you want to do with science is create stories that can be reproduced, that I can give you recipes on how to recreate something. That's what an experiment is and what a theory is, right? Like, is if you follow this and this and this, if I take a ball and I take it 2 meters high and I drop it, then it's gonna fall in whatever the time it takes, right? So I can give you that. I can give you a recipe that you can go and buy the ball and put it 2 meters high and drop it and look in your watch and see that the time that corresponds, the amount of time that happened between the dropping and the bottom of the ball, take the amount of time that you're predicting that is. But what you're giving is an algorithm, a recipe on how to recreate experiences. And I think that's is very valid, right? Like, and that takes you to the other end of the spectrum, and is that there are many people in that study esoteric and the occult world that they're charlatans at the end. They're just are giving opinions without anything else. Like, and I have a big aversion to, like, when people do that, I like my immune system wakes up and it's like, oh my God, how can I give me a way to reproduce that? If you give me a way where I can experience that, then I can buy that. Otherwise, is your opinion, dude. Like, and I have a big problem with that. And there's a lot of people that do that and then make these alternative ideas very muddy. Because you're trying to find what is true and what is speculation, and splitting that is very hard. Because if you're speculating, the first thing that you should do when you speculate is say, "Hey, I'm speculating," not bring that as a fact, right? Like, but a lot of people do it.
And they do because whether they have an agenda or they feel like they're on a mission or they feel like they got some kind of divine download that's undeniable, so they just go ahead and go with it. It's interesting, but the people now, it seems, are at least opening up to this type of information. Quantum physics, you're talking about science approaching that. They can't explain consciousness because we're light beings. We're not our body, we're in our body. And when you have that revelation, that blows your mind. But science isn't there yet. However, all of that scientific knowledge came through inspiration, which is a magical act in itself. You're changing your frequency to open up to this potential and trying to channel these ideas. So because of that, the scientific information does have value. It just can't run the show. In ancient Egypt, let me tell you, people, they had a whole different type of science. How they built the pyramids, how they interfaced with each other, relationships, astrology, all of that. It was completely different than now. So tell me about how you connected, because we could talk about 70 things for hours. Obviously, we're similar frequency people, but tell me how you connected with the Egyptian culture and how you really got passionate about that.
Okay, so the first thing is that at the beginning, I was very skeptic or reluctant to get into studying Egypt, because to me, it was a big investment. Because it's so foreign and so different from what we're accustomed to, that it looks completely alien. And when you look at it, it's like, oh my God, the investment of time that it's going to take for me to try to understand this, if I can ever understand it, is going to be so big that I don't know if it's worth it. But at some point in my life, I came across the ceiling of the subject matter of the book. And the images that I saw there were so precious and so beautiful that it awakened on me the need to understand what this is. And I was like, oh my God, I really have to do the investment on getting to know what this civilization was about, because it's profound and it's sublime and it's beautiful. And that's what came is through beauty. Sheer beauty enticed me to study Egyptology and this ceiling.
So then You also, though, in 2010, went to a Tutankhamun exhibit, right? I believe I went to the same one that was on tour in San Francisco, where they recreated the Tutankhamun tomb and the burial chamber and things and other things. They did have some authentic things, but they had some replicas as well. And that also fired you up in that way.
Correct. So it was like my first contact with images or 3D objects from Egypt, like really up and close. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, I really have to see a real thing. And then my daughters were young at the time. We decided to just take 2 weeks off and go to Egypt and visit different sites in Egypt. And one of the places that I didn't expect was this temple. And that's, so I was amazed by the pyramids and all the sightseeing there, which is fantastic and beautiful. And it sparks your imagination. It's like what I was telling you. I think when Elon Musk talks about going to Mars, can I share you a secret? I think Mars is so boring. You land on Mars and you have your helmet and you look around and it's just a freaking desert.
Yeah, it's orange.
You look at rocks. Like after 10 minutes in Mars, what the hell are you going to do? Nothing. You just want to come back, right? There is nothing. But imagine that you landed in Mars and all of a sudden what you find is covered in sand, all these structures from an alien culture. Then all of a sudden it becomes fascinating. That's Egypt. Egypt, in a big part, is Mars because it's just a desert, right? Where you find these magnificent monuments built by this mysterious civilization in the past, where we can go there and we can talk about when all this was built and all this if you want. But the sense that you're in front of something that is a big mystery is there. So to me, going to Egypt is way better than going to Mars. Any day of the week, I would go first there.
Well, you never know.
I can still breathe here.
Yeah, well, you never know. Once we go to Mars, there may be pyramids there. There may be that same type of ruins. I believe
that would be interesting.
It could be possible.
But if it's only rocks, then
bore. Egypt is beautiful, though, because like you said, there's hidden history. It's an ancient culture. It's a world that, in a sense, was lost, because even by Cleopatra's time, it had changed so much from where it had started originally. But when you were in Dendera and you were seeing these beautiful images in person, did you think about that Tutankhamun exhibit and how they recreated that, and then maybe had the idea of, wow, I could recreate this in book form? Because that's the most beautiful thing about the book. It's like if you're disabled, if you can't travel, you literally have all of it right there. I mean, the image is everything.
Well, in a way, yes, I would say yes, but the book was my attempt to understand something that was out of reach to me. And the book is the book that I wanted to buy to understand what happened in the ceiling. And I look for it. I shop around. And the funny thing is that the literature about this ceiling is very technical and is very specialized in Egyptological books. And most of it is written either in French or in German. So at the end, there is no literature about this ceiling. So this book is the book that I wanted to buy to explain to me what this ceiling is about. And it wasn't available, so I had to put it together out of sheer necessity.
So tell me, what is special about this Dendera temple? And tell me about the ceiling. Let's get into that.
Perfect. So what is special about this temple, probably the most interesting thing about this temple, is that it is probably the best preserved temple of Egypt.
Really?
And even though it's a late temple, it was built at the time of Cleopatra, basically year 50 BC. It's around the time where they start to build the current structure of this temple. And so it's, in relative terms, it's a new temple.
Right.
But So, but it's 2,000 years. It's incredibly old
it,
still, right?
It's still connected to the original ancient Egyptian culture that started, that original foundational culture.
Now, this temple was built in the late period where the Greeks have been there, have conquered Egypt for 300 years. So they had Greek ruling for 300 years. And the language in Egypt, right, like the writing language, have become in big part Greek, and all the edicts and things like that were written in Greek. And ancient Egyptian, the language, was relegated to mostly religious functions and things. So, but the other thing is that if you look at this temple and you look at the imagery, one of the fantastic things about Egypt is that all these outside influences that they had alter very little the Egyptian culture.
Really?
So in this ceiling, when you look at this ceiling, and that's something that always intrigued me, is that you look at a culture that lasted probably like 6,000 years. And when you look at the Egyptian culture, the art and the sensitivity of the art and the way things are depicted is pretty much constant. So they have a time, right, when they decided to become, they had one pharaoh that decided, oh, we're going to become monotheistic.
Right.
And they changed the art style for one generation only, and then they reverted back into the ancient aesthetics. And but you look at Egyptian images, and they're very, very, very specific. And is they're always the bodies are always like looking sideways, and just like walk like an Egyptian, right, like kind of thing, with the faces looking sideways. And the sense of aesthetics in Egypt is pretty much preserved, and is very conservative. And so for all this time, the culture was pretty much the same. And which is fascinating. Now, in this temple, because after 300 years of Greek influence, then what is interesting about this temple is that in the ceiling of this temple, the first thing, going back to where I was, one of the fascinating things about this temple is that it's incredibly well preserved. So the temple is as if it was built yesterday. Because in perfect shape, the colors, the original colors, all the roofs are in place. Is the structure is in perfect shape.
Was it preserved? So just to stop you here for a second, Jose, was it preserved intentionally, or was it just fate that happened to preserve it that way?
Sure, luck.
Okay.
So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
These structures, a lot of these temples, what happened is that when the Egyptian civilization dwindled down, right, and they were conquered by the Romans, and then the Romans start to have internal struggles and so on. And in the year 300 AD, Christianity takes over, right, with Constantine. And the last temples that were left in Egypt, it was basically the temples and the Egyptian religion was the political institution of the time. So it was a theocracy, and the emperor was the ruler, but he was the chief priest on the country, and he was the image of God. So religion and politics were the same thing, were synonyms, because they were one. It was a theocracy. So the Roman emperors became the pharaohs, and it's more in this temple, this particular temple, you can read the names of the Roman emperors who were later on banking and sponsoring the temples, because they wanted to have a presence in Egypt, and they were the new pharaohs. But then with the advent of Christianity and the decline of Rome, when Constantine was there was a crisis in Rome, and they were going bankrupt, and they corrupted themselves out of
right.
to extinction. And then the Roman Empire split it into two, and Christianity came, and then all the sponsoring of these temples basically stopped, because they didn't put more money on them. And because of Christianity, all these other religions went away, because Christianity took over. And these temples, got abandoned because they were very expensive to maintain, and they're in a dry area where it rains once a year, once every decade or something, so in the middle of the desert. So water and humidity is one of the things that destroy a lot of these sites, is that, right? Like water is very bad for conserving colors and things like that. But this place is dry, and a lot of these temples and ruins got covered in sand, which helps them be preserved. And this temple happened to be untouched by 2,000 years, because a lot of other structures, they took the stones out of them in order to build other houses and other things. So you can go, it's very interesting today. You can go in Egypt, and there is, for example, a sugar processing factory that was dismantled in the 1800s. And you go to the factory today, and it has hieroglyphs on certain walls, because they took the rocks of a temple, and which were covered in hieroglyphs, and they used them to build the factory. And that happened a lot in Egypt. So they basically took the rocks out to build our structures. But this one, out of sheer luck, was left untouched. And when it got abandoned, some Bedouins start to live inside the temple, and they used to make fire buns at night, because in the desert at night it
Yeah, it's
gets really
cold.
cold, and they used to cook inside this. They start to live in these temples. And so what happened is that this soot from the smoke covered the ceilings, and they became like black, and the colors disappear under a layer of soot. And basically, the Egyptian government, like a decade ago, decided to clean up the ceiling in this temple, and all the colors, the original colors, were underneath that layer of soot. And when it got removed, the colors came back to life, and the
Oh my
ceiling looks as if new.
God. And that was just 10 years ago.
Like in the last decade.
Wow, my God. That's incredible. So, what was the main function of Dendera?
So again, temples were a political institution mostly, right? And religious. So it was, but they were centers, very important. It's not like today, like the temples or the churches that you see today are places only for worship, right? On Sunday mornings or whatever it is, when you have the worship, and people go there and gather there to worship, and that's it. No, these temples were surrounded by all these other infrastructures, and they were the administrative branch of the government. So, for example, one of the functions that they had was, which is very interesting, is that all these temples were on the banks of the Nile, and they have something called a nilometer, which is basically a well on the side of the temple where the water of the Nile comes into the well. And then they had marks on the side of the temple, on the of the well, sorry. And as you had the flooding of the Nile, then the water rises on the well, and they could measure what was the how much flood was happening with the Nile on that year. And then using that information of how much the flooding, how deep it was, or how much water was there, they used that to calibrate how much taxes they would levy on the population.
Oh, damn. That's
So if you think
incredible.
about it, it's incredibly sophisticated. So,
It is.
but you can see how this is a religious infrastructure, but on the side, they're managing the economy
Yeah,
of the
the
country
taxes.
and the economical policies of the country, like by measuring the amount of water in the Nile, which, by the way, the IRS is not even near of having a level of complexity and sophistication as big as that, right? You pay today, like, I don't know, they have we have a scale 20, 30, 40, depending on how much you make. And it doesn't matter how good the economy is or how bad or whatever, you always have to pay the same amount, the same percentage. These guys calibrated how much money they would extract from the population based on how much water was on the flooding, because that determined how much yield they could get out of the land, and how much crops they could get, and so on. So that was a way to calibrate in a
Whoa.
fair way how much they would extract from people, because if they got too much, then they would have a revolt on their hands.
Right. Wow, I've never, dude, nobody's ever explained that to me before. That's absolutely mind-blowing. And shows, again, the sophistication of this culture, but using that as a fair way to tax your citizens. Whoa!
So the level of the water of the Nile was used as an economic indicator.
Right, because
to
then
see how
the
much
soil,
they charge on taxes.
Right, the soil would be then, you know, you'd be able to grow that much more. They knew if people had that much more access to water, based on these certain calculations, it would mean that they would be able to yield this on average, which would mean, wow, that's incredible. Correct. But the ceiling itself of the temple has an astrological significance. That's like the hugest part of it. Can you tell me about that?
Correct. So another function of the temples was they were astronomical observatories, and they were used to track and measure the movement of the stars, and out of that create calendars. So the biggest existential issue that they had in Egypt was, so think about Egypt.
Okay.
Egypt is in the middle of a desert where you have a very long, 1,000-mile river that is the Nile. And this river, before it was dammed in the 50s, in the 1950s, before it was dammed, what happened to the river is that in Ethiopia, it rains once a year, like in March, and then in the mountains in Ethiopia, and then out of these mountains, all these torrential rains that happen in Ethiopia make a lot of water, right, that comes down from the rain and come down the Nile. And then once a year, the Nile floods on the banks of this desert, and it brings all these fertilizers from the mountains in Ethiopia, and all these fertilizers get into the banks of the river. And then when the water recedes, what you have is you just created the most fertile land on earth.
Right.
And when that happens, Egypt is a paradox, because Egypt is this desert which happens to have the most fertile land on the planet. But this thing is not always the case. So it's cyclical, because the river dries and floods once a year. So think about it in terms of water and dryness. And imagine that you could look from a satellite, the Nile River. So what you're going to see is that if you could speed it up, what you would see is that the river is like breathing, because the water comes out and comes back in, right? As the river dries, the water recedes, you have fertile land.
Yes.
And you take all your crops, but then it dries up and it becomes desert again. So Egypt is this fight between life and death, literally, because it's the fertility of the green land against the desert and the dryness of the desert, and it's always coming back and forth, once a year, periodically, because it happens once a year. So what was a matter of crucial, an existential threat to the Egyptians, or a factor, was to know when the flooding would happen, because that determined when they had to plant and when they had to prepare the soil and when they had. So all the Egyptian life revolved around the cycle of the Nile, because their life depended on it.
Right.
So they used the ceiling on these temples in order to look at the stars, because they found, so the stars have one characteristic, and is that their movement is periodical and is precise. And it happens, the earth spins once a day,
right?
At the same speed every day. And it goes once around the sun, and then the moon You can see the phases of the moon once every 28 point whatever days and so on. But these are rhythmical periodic cycles that you can, that they're constant cycles. The frequency of these cycles is constant. So you can use them to measure time. And then when you find a correlation between the movement of the stars and the flooding of the Nile, which happened to be the advent of the star Sirius on the horizon, the first time on the year, or the first time after some time of period of time, when you see this star coming down, coming up in the morning for the first time, you know when you see that star that the flood is about to come. And
Whoa.
then so what they were doing was they were looking at the beings in the sky, at their gods in the sky, to foretell the future, which is namely what we understand today as astrology. But you can see that this is a
Oh my
scientific process
God.
because they are basically, so the function, the real function of the temple and the religion is that it's a pacemaker. A pacemaker that is synchronized with the movement of the stars. And what it does is it converts those movements into rituals and festivals and ceremonies that in turn tell society how to behave and what activities they should perform. So what the purpose of the priests and the institution of the temple was to keep in harmony the lives of the Egyptians with the harmonies of the gods, with the
Oh
movement
my
of the gods.
God.
So, if you think about it,
Oh,
it's the
this is
way.
mind-blowing. My God. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So what it is, and at the end, what it is a way to maintain your society in harmony with its given environment. And the reason why they were able to persevere and last for so long is because if they were going against the grain of their environment, they would have died. Because if they couldn't time the flooding of the Nile or whatever, then they would die of starvation. And what is super interesting is that this is a regular movement. It's mostly regular. The flooding of the Nile was mostly regular, but it had periods of disarrangement where there was too much water or there was not too much water. And then you look at the periods in the Egyptian history of a societal upheaval and revolutions and problems like political conflict, and it happens to coincide with these periods of disruption in the cycles of the Nile. Because
Wow.
if society becomes too poor because, say, for a decade there wasn't too much water coming down the Nile, then what happens is that your society becomes starving, right? And this is, by the way, this is captured in the Bible, in the story of the cows. I don't know if you remember that. There is a story in the Bible. Let me look for it, but it's basically the years of the when
I
the
can feel
cows.
it in the back of my brain. It's in there
Yeah,
somewhere.
I'll tell. I'm spacing out.
I will just say while you're looking that up, Jose, this has been riveting conversation. I love Egyptian culture, and when you talk and just your knowledge, it's like nectar. I'm just like just absolutely engrossed in what you're saying.
Yeah, sorry, I was looking for it. But yeah, basically, there is this parable in the Bible where there are the years of the good years and the bad years. And basically, let me see. I have the story somewhere, but I can. So the story goes something like, for the years that there was no good water in the Nile, then the cows become skinny and die, right? Like, so the insight that they had was that you should be saving food in the good years to be able to use it in the bad years. And that's, well, it'll come back to me anyway.
So you're saying that's kind of where that concept of like kind of like storing things and keeping reserves came into play on a mass scale.
Right. So all of a sudden becomes like state policy, right? Is based on that, right? Like how much are we gonna save and how much not, depending on how much worry we're gonna have. And but that what that shows you is that at the end, the prosperity of a society is related in a huge way to the way your environment is and the way your ways are in agreement or disagreement with that environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when things happen, like you said, the bad years, that destabilization, it ripples through and it starts to change foundational things in society. As long as there's energy, which you could say the Nile was a form of energy. I'm sure they thought of it as spiritual energy, but this energy, these resources come in. If the energy is destabilized, then that's going to cause distortion in all other avenues of life in a culture, it seems like. And that it seems possible that they could have lasted longer if they managed it better. But do you think it's strange that 6,000 years of history is just like it's can be summed up in thoughts and books? There's so much lost, so many lives, so many people lived their entire lives. Does that ever just blow you away? The amount of people, the information, the whole universe that's kind of like almost like a memory now?
Yeah, can you imagine that? Like, so look at the pyramids and don't look at them just like what they are today, but imagine what they represent, right? Like how many lives and how much effort of how many unnamed people that went through the process of creating this pyramid. So just think about that. Like is anonymous armies of people who put rocks upon rock upon rock, like thousands of years ago. And today we have their mark, they have the scar that they left on planet Earth, which is namely the pyramids. But is those are not the pyramids are not just a pile of rocks. They are the effort of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people concentrated and deposited on what is today the pyramid, but it's a concentration of the life effort of many people. And I think that's one of the things that really infuriates me. I don't know, like if you saw this morning, this stupid environmentalist went to the Louvre
Oh, the
and
Mona
threw
Lisa. That
the Mona Lisa.
somebody assaulted the Mona Lisa. I literally almost cried. I'm so frustrated. I think billions of people are frustrated about that. Go ahead.
Oh my God, like it's an assault on humanity.
I know.
Like, I don't know how you can relate those who justify one thing with the other.
You
So,
can't.
like, how is that gonna change anything, right? Like to me, iconoclasm is a horrendous thing because you're disrespecting the lives of all these people in the past that had these magnificent accomplishments, and you're just destroying them. Like I find that the most horrendous thing you can ever do. And I think it's counterproductive, by the way. Well, it's counterproductive to do what they do. Because people
Oh,
hate this. It's horrible. It's like
absolutely. Can you imagine if someone or one of these groups that feel like they're vindicated and causing timeless destruction, what if they attacked the pyramids? How do you think the Egyptian government would respond if some of these eco-terrorists tried to attack the pyramid? They would probably be killed because this is something that's priceless. It's a treasure to humanity. And that is, like you said, the psychic energy of hundreds, perhaps who knows how many people put their energy into it, but all of it's there stored in this crystalline form. We see it as a structure, but energetically, it's an energetic pyramid. All of the people's intention, their willpower, their psychic energy, their love, all of it, their
Their
stress, all
fears, their
yes,
sweat, all of it.
everything went
Yeah,
into that. And
correct.
that's what it really is. And correct. It stands through time. And to me, in my own personal opinion, I think it's a symbol of another universe to show humanity that their world, the world we're in now, is just one of many worlds that have come and gone. And maybe to not get so attached to this world and how we think it's so important, how we process it.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing that is interesting is that the art is a reflection of the human spirit. So one of the things that is beautiful about art is that, by the way, I was last week with my daughter at the Guggenheim Museum.
Okay.
And we're looking at the art that they have there, which is mostly modern art. And what is beautiful about that place is that it perfectly reflects the ideology of the society where we live. So you look at all these modern pieces like Rothko's or things like this that you see in these modern art museums, which are just a splash of paint on a wall or whatever right. It is that you're doing. What they lack is spirit.
Mm.
And I personally collect religious art because of what you were saying, because that piece of art, what it has is the intention of the builder, of the person, the artist that was behind that piece. What they did is they put all this divine intention into the creation of a religious piece of art. So when you look at the statue of a saint or a crucifix or anything for that, a statue of a Buddha, it is not just a statue of the Buddha. The way I see it is the labor of the person who made that,
right,
or the people who made that. And that's, if your intention is divine, then that object is divine because of that intention.
Absolutely.
If you're Rothko and you throw just a bucket of paint against a wall, then your intention is not divine. And what is beautiful about art is what I'm saying is whatever is the intention of the artist is what ends up being reflected on the art. So art is a portrait of the spirit of the culture at any time. So by looking at art, you can kind of you can have an intuition of what was
the depth of
the people. Correct.
Yes, the complexity.
And that's what is beautiful about Egypt and the art in Egypt is that is deeply sacred and deeply religious, because the world for the Egyptians was not a void world as it is today to us, which were utilitarian. No, their world was made by expressions of the gods.
Right. Yes, so we were talking about
every
that
animal,
earlier.
Every animal, every house object, everything was an incarnation of aspects of the gods. So their world and the Nile and nature and all these things were sacred places. Yeah, a river is not just a utilitarian place where I'm going to dam it and create energy and get water and get fish out. But it is a holy entity, it's a sacred entity. And we lost that in our society. We lost the capacity to look for the divine on things and on our world, because we live in a world that is meaningless.
Right.
Because the ideology behind our world, and going back to this, tells us that we're just a universal accident. And it's ideological. If you're not the main character of your story, then you live with oppression, you live in consumerism, you get high, you get drunk every weekend because there is nothing else to do. It's
right.
Nihilistic.
It is, but you think about Native American cultures and other Native cultures around the world. A lot of them did have a similar worldview in that way to ancient Egyptians, where they saw the divine in everything, even the most mundane, simple things, was the absolution of the divine. And getting back to the sacredness of Egyptian art, when you were at the Temple of Dendera, that is probably what struck you the most, right? And you tried to capture that. You wanted to capture that. Describe that process a little bit. Like, you're in the temple, you want to photograph this, you already do photography and things like this, but you wanted to make sure this was available for all time. Talk about that.
Okay, so I've been in many sacred places, like cathedrals around Europe or in Asia, temples in Asia, things like that. But I had never been in front of a divine presence, absent like in nature. Like you go in the wilderness, or
yeah,
you go to a beautiful landscape somewhere, and you can sense this presence of the divine in those places. But man-made places, I've been in many sacred places around the world, and I never sense the presence of the divine in these places. They never talk to me. When I went into his temple, you can feel this overwhelming, I could feel this overwhelming presence in this temple. And this temple, what has beautiful is consecrated to the goddess Hathor. And the goddess Hathor was the goddess mostly of life and fertility. So it's a temple to life, basically.
Okay.
And you can feel it. And the whole temple represents a womb. And it's incredible because you look at the temple, and we can go on that tangent, but the temple represents the womb and the place where life is created.
Okay.
And then they had the statue of the goddess inside the temple, and every year in a ritual, they used to take the statue to the roof of the temple, where she is the wife of Horus, which is the sun. So they use, in separate, in special moments during the year, take the statue to the roof of the temple to get the first light of the sun, to impregnate the statue with the light of the sun. And they could conceive life in that way. So it's this symbolic way of enacting the miracle of life, the Immaculate Conception, which is very similar to the Immaculate Conception in Christianity. And is, if you think about it, is a deep mystery, a deep miracle, the creation of life out of nothing.
Yes.
And that is a real magical process where you're making life out of nothing. And is, we have that magical purpose, like that magical strength. We have that relic, creation of life, the conception of life. And that's been portrayed beautifully, for example, in Christian images, in the Annunciation. So that's a beautiful image of the moment where life becomes manifest in the terrain, in our world. That's the Immaculate Conception, right?
Like, right.
And it's exactly that. It's beautiful. It's a sacred, spiritual, transcendental mystery. We don't know how it happens, right? And that's being depicted like that. And then you take any of these scenes in this mysterious ceiling, and they represent sacred moments like that. And the funny thing is that we anthropomorphize these things, and all these properties in nature, the way they did it in antiquity, is that they created all these plethora of gods. So the Egyptians had like 100 different gods, or I don't know how many. Like, and the funny thing is that if you look at it like literally from today backwards, what you say is, wow, these people were just a bunch of primitive, superstitious people who believe in gods with animal heads, right? Like, that's what you believe at face value when you see this. But when you realize that these are symbols and these are proxies for the fundamental forces that shape our reality, then you open your eyes to a deeper understanding on all this symbology and all the deep knowledge that cultures like this is like one of the highest points on understanding spiritually in humanity, and you can see it in their art. It's sublime. So the beauty of their art, the harmony in their art, reflects their inner knowledge. So you can get a sense of how profound and deep their knowledge is by looking at their art, at their because their products are the secretion of their inner spiritual life. And that's why they're so harmonious and beautiful.
And this one specifically, when you went to photograph it, did you have any issues with the Egyptian authorities? Did they allow you to do this carte blanche? Like you didn't have any problems? Like, tell me about the actual photography process.
Oh, so it took me 3 days to photograph the whole ceiling. So what happens is that you go to these temples and you can buy, when you go to the temples in Egypt, they sell you something that is the photography pass. So if you take your phone, you can just take photos. But then if you have a camera, then you buy a permit that is the photograph permit. And then people who bring like people who bring their cameras, then you pay extra money and then you can go and take photos, selfies of yourself there. But no one tells you that with the camera, you can take like just $5,000 photos of the ceiling, right? Like it's, you can take selfies or do what I did, basically.
So. Wow, interesting. So you never had any problems there. But then the photos themselves, I mean, do you feel like you really captured everything? Like, it seems like you did. I mean, page by page, you're breaking things down. You're breaking down each section, each deity, each function. I mean, do you really feel like you got everything?
No, not really. And it's what we were
because
talking
there's
about
so before. Much there. It's mind blowing. I'm like, there's hundreds. Yes. It's like 200 and something pages. Like, it's beautiful.
Right.
But there's more.
So the first thing is, just like we were talking about chocolate.
Yes.
Like reading on a book about the place.
Uh-huh.
And being at the presence of this temple. Like the sensation that you get of being at this place in situ when you're right there is overwhelming. It's like you will never capture that with a book or
right, exactly.
That's you can't. So that's number one. Number two is that you can capture the pixels of what is on the ceiling. And today you can kind of translate what the text that accompany these images are. But the real meaning of what these texts represent, I think, is lost in a big part. Because, and going back to the idea that we use reason today to understand things, there are other modes of understanding, like symbolically, which is a very rich way of understanding things. But the problem with when you use symbology is that there is all this implicit knowledge on the people who know the symbols that is not poured out on the symbols.
Right.
But you know what it is. And absent that, you lose a big part of the of what the significance of the symbols are. Because you lack the context.
Right.
And the problem with these religions, like the religion of the ancient Egypt, is that it was an initiatory process where a lot of the knowledge was just mouth to ear from one priest to another, and it was a secret knowledge that only they knew. So you can have all these gods today, and we can kind of think what they meant and what properties they meant and so on and so forth. But a lot of it is lost because he died with the last priests of Egypt, basically.
Well, it just blows me away that a culture that was that powerful, that had that level of understanding, spiritual, esoteric, magical, all of the above, and then lasted for so long, could just fade away. Like, what happens there? Is it truly just the cycles of life, or was there some cataclysm? Like, it just blows me away because you're talking 6,000 years or more, really. And yet the Egypt of today is not the same Egypt, though the people are there, the monuments are there.
It,
but
It's in ruins. Like the reality today is that Egypt became a third world country after being the powerhouse of the universe, basically. Today is a country in ruins and a third world country, very poor. And it lost its glory, right? But these gods were so powerful that even though in ruins today, they bring the sustenance today to Egypt, because most of the of the of or a big chunk, I think 25 or something percent of the economy in Egypt
Yeah, it's tourism.
depends on tourism. And what it is all these gringos that are interested in going and sightseeing there, and is the power of the Egyptian gods. So even in ruins, they were so powerful that today, in a very, and this is the other paradox that you see in Egypt, right? And is that it's an Islamic country and is not the most the most conservative of them, but it's very conservative. And yet, when you walk around, all you see are the Egyptian gods everywhere because of tourism and their
Right, because
heritage and all this.
Muslims,
They're everywhere.
Muslims and the religion of Islam is usually very, very strict about
On
those things. The deities of other religions, they would just annihilate them.
correct, but in this place, because it's their sustenance, they cannot get rid of of the Egyptian gods. And so you walk around, and if you didn't know
That's
that
huge.
they are Muslim, right? You would imagine the Egyptians gods are still well and alive there because they're everywhere in every corner.
But it still is practice, though. I bet even in Egypt there are still underground mystery schools maintaining the lineage. And then you think about things like Freemasonry, which seem to adopt some of the ancient Egyptian mystery school situations and other mystery schools as well. You know,
I agree.
they're carrying on some aspect of the legacy.
Absolutely. There is a lot of knowledge that we don't know is there, right? And if
There's still
it's
more to be
secret,
discovered.
and if it's secret knowledge, by definition, we will not know, right?
Well, it's all coming to the surface. It does seem like in humanity's history right now, we're moving towards this new world. We're ascending. All of that mystery school information, that ancient knowledge is coming to the surface. So I don't think any of it is going to be secret for much longer, just because all of that is necessary to be accessed for us to evolve as humans.
That's probably correct. However, Jesus Christ at some point said you shouldn't cast the pearls to the swine.
I
So,
know.
and what happens with this knowledge, right, is that I don't know. Yeah, I'm open to
I
giving
know. No,
knowledge
you're
to
right. I
everyone,
mean, I just have a problem.
but
Go ahead.
one thing is giving the knowledge to people. And the other one is people hearing and listening and paying attention to that knowledge and understanding the knowledge. And I think at some point, if you're not prepared to understand, you will not understand. So understanding comes from you, not from the outside world.
Right.
So the vision, yeah, you can impede people, you can maintain people in the dark, and you can try to maintain people illiterate and so on. So you can do that. But and you can try to enlighten people by giving them, but enlightenment itself comes from you, and it's an inner process. I don't think you can force people to become enlightened.
No, definitely not. But I'm hoping that collectively, we are just evolving. People talk about the age of Aquarius. There's other different situations that seem to show that, you know, we're getting back to a different frequency, a love-based frequency. All of those things that were lost, we will regain that. I kind of think that. Did Egyptian culture speak to that at all? Did they ever talk about the return to a golden age or something similar?
So what is interesting about Egypt, right, is that one of the things that they had is that time wasn't linear, time was cyclical.
Right.
And so basically the time reset itself on every generation of the pharaoh. So they were incredibly autocratic and centralized, right? Like, and the pharaoh was God incarnate, and he was the absolute ruler, and everything depended on the pharaoh. So time and the chronologies are told on the 7th year of emperor or pharaoh XYZ. And then when he died, then the next emperor, the time reset it and the calendar reset it on the new one, and time started again. So they have all these circles or these cycles, but they were based on the life of the emperor, because the world revolved around the pharaohs.
Right.
Now the return as such, like it exists, for example, in India, right? That they have the yugas and the idea of these
Right.
different
Exactly.
times. I'm not aware of that in Egypt, to tell you the truth. Now,
Really?
what they had and is in their ideology, what they have is that everything grows and then declines and dies and is born again. So that's the core, the myth of Isis and Osiris is exactly that, right? Is so you can think, if you think of that in scientific terms, what it's doing is characterizing the different phases of a cycle. So if you think in terms of what is a cycle, right? A cycle is something that repeats itself, and mathematically, what it is you have an origin where the cycle starts, can be any point in the cycle. And then what you have is a phase of expansion, what you're doing is you're getting away from that origin. And then there is a point where things stop. And then the movement is reversed back into contraction. And then you go back to the origin. So any cyclical movement, what it has is a phase of expansion and a phase of contraction, and again and again and again and again. And that's what characterizes any, and you can describe that mathematically, right? With sines and cosines and trigonometry is the science of quantifying cycles. And you can always see, like if you see a sinusoidal, that is like this camel hump and then goes down and goes up again and down, then it has a place where you go up, and then when you're at the top, at the zenith, then you stop, and there is a, for an instant, you're in standing still with respect to the origin, and then you start to go back to the origin. You start to go down, 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 and then up, and down, 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 and up. And so, in a way, yes, any cycle and anything has a phase of growth and then decline and death and resurrection, and which is beautifully depicted in the ceiling, by the way. In one of the panels in the ceiling, what you have is the daily cycle of the sun. So what you see is the sun during the hours of the day, since sunrise to sunset, and then what the sun is represented as is a character that in the morning is a toddler, and then as the day starts to go up, he starts to grow up, as the sun starts to rise in the sky, and then in the middle of the morning he's a teenager, and then at noon he becomes a ram with 4 heads in the ceiling, and he's in a boat, because they imagine that the sun, they imagine the sky to be like the Nile. And then the sun was navigating, crossing, journeying through the Nile on a boat, the boat of the sun.
Okay.
And then the character, but if you think about it, today we look at the sun and it's, oh yeah, that's a nuclear reactor that is 8 minute years, like 8 minute, 8 minute, 8 light minutes away from Earth, which is producing radiation. And is this dead thing that is just, it's a heater that is producing heat, right? That's pretty much what we see today. For them, the sun was this living entity that was organic, and it had different characteristics different qualities depending on the hour of the day. So in the morning, at sunrise, the sun is, you can imagine it, is this little kid that doesn't produce too much energy or light. And as it starts to grow and the day starts to advance, then it starts to get stronger and bigger and more mature. And at noon is at its full potency, right? And
Yes.
its full vigor and vitality. And that's the point where you're the
Right.
furthest from the origin. And then it starts to, in the afternoon, it starts to dwindle down and decline. And the sun starts to get more mellow and less heat, right? And the way they represented it was an aging person. And then at the time of sunset, what they represented it, the sun as, was an old guy with a cane. And you can see this in the book, in the section
Yes.
of the sun, and right before he dies. So basically, they made this analogy between the different moments of the sun during the day with the age of people, but you're encapsulating on that all these mathematical quantities that we're talking about, frequencies, like in a cycle that you have expansion and contraction and all those things that you have on a cyclical movement or event, then all of that is encoded in these beautiful images of boats with the sun. And to me, that's the right way to understand and read these things as much as I can, right? And because beyond that, there are things that can be right in front of you, but because we lack the context, we
Right.
cannot read them.
Like you were saying, consciousness and cycles are pretty much the only thing that are measurable and we can experience in a constant way that we know are just like unchangeable.
Correct.
That's mind blowing. It's just like, I'm sitting here, Jose, and my mind is just blown with the things you're talking about because this is really in depth in how Egyptians thought and the advancement that they were at because their knowledge, what they accomplished, is rippling through time, not just with the pyramids and the architecture, but all of that spiritual understanding, the power of the Egyptian gods is still there. It's still there.
Because they were talking about universal truths.
Yes.
And so those things are eternal. Universal truths are as valid as they were 2,000 years ago, they're valid today. And the inner life of Egyptians 2 or 4 or 6,000 years ago, well, they were just human beings like you and I today. So the deep observations that they made about human nature is still relevant today because we're the same people.
Right, exactly, and in a way, we look up to them even to even now, spiritual people, intelligent people, intellectual people, they still look to ancient Egypt and look up to it as this paragon of humanity. Like we accomplished something there that we don't have today. It's really interesting. So
Correct.
tell me, Jose, what is the most important thing that you learned from this whole project? You went there, you photographed this, you integrated those energies, you became a part of it. What is the most important thing you feel like you gained from this?
The deepest insight, probably like thinking about this place and this book, is that that place and Egypt was inevitable in the sense that what is now so nice about an autochthonous place like Egypt is that once you pass the shocking images of deities with heads of animals and so on, and when you look at them deeply, what you realize is that the animals that these deities have are the autochthonous animals of the Nile. And so when you look at the hieroglyphs, what they are is the flora and fauna of the Nile.
Right.
So the Egyptian culture is as Egyptian as there are, as the palm trees and the dates and the animals of Egypt are. These temples are the produce, and they're the product of the Nile. and that environment and the people there. So they're completely autochthonous and they are in complete harmony, or as far as you humanly can, in harmony with the place and time where they happened. And that's beautiful because Egypt, in a way, was not an imported culture, but it was a culture autochthonous that grew up there. So, not like today. Today, we don't have that experience because we live with a borrowed language, which is not, it was just brought to us by a culture far away some time ago. But it's not like, for example, something that is fascinating and always I think about is that my name is Jose, right? Or you, Jake. Those names, today, they're just pointers. They don't mean anything. It's just a pointer to, it's
Right.
an abstract name. Like when you look at names, for example, in India or names in Japan or of people, a name has a meaning. So someone can be called, I don't know, in India, the name means the wise person of the morning or whatever it is. So the name itself is not an abstract pointer to something, but it has character. It has
Substance, it has meaning.
substance. It has substance, correct. So I think when you're part of an autochthonous society, and it's not like the imposition of a conqueror, which is what happens with Christianity, basically, is a religion of the or Islam, which is religions of conquerors that go and impose these religions around the world, right, where they conquered. The connection that you have to it is imposed. It's not autochthonous. It doesn't grow out from the ground up, from the land. What I think that is the most sublime thing about Egypt is that place is the product of the Nile. The
Yes.
temples are the product of the Nile. Their art is the product of the Nile and the place. And it's beautiful.
Damn.
It's the transmutation of the Nile into art and
Oh.
into shapes. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Oh my God, Jose. That's incredible. That is that. And it's, if you were this extraterrestrial and you're just watching humanity and you could see that pulse of life coming from the Nile and then spreading out and the energy that came from that, the geometry behind that, the energy behind that must be astounding. Oh my God. Jose, you've really blown my mind today. I'm sorry if I've just been sitting here with my jaw open most of the time listening to these incredible things you're telling us, but I just could, I'm just absolutely blown away by your breadth of knowledge on this subject. This is just incredible.
Well, it's my hobby, it's my passion.
Well, we're gonna have you back on because we're talking about your book today, Dendera Temple of Time, but you seem to know incredible amount about Egypt. I'd love to bring you back on at some point to just talk about the history of Egypt, talk about everything, the magical aspect, the things that were lost. We'll talk about that part another time. But Dendera Temple of Time is the book that we're talking about today. It's available anywhere that you can get books. His website is josemariabarrera.com. So it's josemariabarrera.com. You can go there. There's information about the book and other videos. I don't know what to say, Jose. It's been incredible. I love this. Is there anything else you think that our audience should know about Dendera, about the Temple of Dendera, this Egyptian culture, this energy, that's pushing through time?
Yeah, I think like the purpose of the book is to bring into attention something that is not well known, and I think it deserves to be known. And it's a homage to the thousands of people who worked thousands of years ago building this thing. And what I wanted to do was to give it its due credit. And I think That was the purpose of the book. The whole book is around the images of this ceiling in this temple. And what I wanted to do is the main character of the book is the ceiling and are the images. And the whole book is just trying to give context around the ceiling, so when people look at it, they know what they're looking at, and there is some context and some sense on what is the meaning of it.
Right. Thank you for that. And I just want to add for people that context that he's talking about. It's incredible. When you read the book, there's so many layers. He's talking about what each symbol represents, the history. It's really a great breakdown of the Egyptian spiritual history. If you want a primer on that, it's not just these beautiful photos. There's so much more in this book. And I urge people to check it out for sure. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jose. This has been absolutely incredible.
It was my absolute pleasure, Jake. Thank you so much.
Yes, please hold through the outro music. And everyone, go to the website, go to wherever you get books. Check this book out. And if you love Egyptian culture, you love ancient Egyptian history, oh my God, definitely get this book. You're going to be blown away. Thank you so much again. And everyone, we will see you next week, Midnight on Earth.